Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. When it comes to cutting down trees, which came first, the beavers or the loggers? Dr. Lee Foote at the University of Alberta has been investigating how beavers use roads as dams and what significance this has for road building and forest management. And Calgary writer Bob Bott has co-authored a book on the 50-year history of Weldwood and its predecessors in the Hinton Forest. Along with Bob Udell and Professor Emeritus Peter Murphy, they've compiled an interesting look at the evolution towards sustainable forest management in Alberta. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The beaver was all but exterminated from the wilds of Canada because of the fur trade. But now, thanks to the overwhelming success of efforts to reintroduce the species over the last 50 years, beaver populations are at an all-time high. Beavers cut down trees, and they make dams. And because of their numbers, they're a major concern for human engineers in the forest, the people who make roads for pipeline companies, oil and gas exploration, and logging operations. Dr. Lee Foote is an associate professor in the Department of Renewable Resources at the University of Alberta. He and his graduate students have been studying the role of beavers for the AIM team, a group of scientists researching adaptive forest management.
The adaptive management experiment is a collection of scientists from private consulting groups, from academia, from government, that work to build large-scale experiments and gain insights that are synthetic in nature. Things that tackle problems as large as everything from carbon dynamics in wetlands to road infrastructures to cumulative impacts. And I know that Innovation Alberta has had several of the AIM folks talk about the great footprint concept that Stan Booten uses, the ALCES model that Brad Stelfox has advanced quite far. Some of the boreal impacts on songbirds that Fiona Schmigelow has broken new ground in. Yeah, it's a great synergistic working team sponsored largely by Alberta Pacific Forest Industries. And we learn a lot from each other.
What was the question you were addressing with the research on beavers?
It's a question that's unfolded over the last 3 years. We started with the premise that beavers were going to have a large impact on the downstream effects of riparian zones. The unfolding road network in Alberta has crossed lots and lots of streams, just by getting from one resource area to a production area. And when this happens, you interrupt the hydrologic flow. You force surface water to behave in a groundwater manner. You build up ponds on the upstream side. You change the flow patterns. You reduce the flood pulses downstream. And we really expected the riparian zones upstream and downstream to be quite different. The astute observer, when they're driving around the province, will notice that upstream and downstream along certain roadbeds look very different. Often there'll be dead standing timber on the upstream side where the water is deeper and it's flooded, and lush growth of forests or willow thickets downstream where it's moist ground, but it's perfect gardening conditions, not flooded, not dry. Well, we looked really hard. We happened to catch this in the middle of a four-year drought, so our signal was somewhat muted. But as we were looking at this, we started changing our question. Roads are there, roads are important, but the beavers are there in spades. Beavers have come back dramatically in the last 50 years, and their impact on the landscape is probably far in excess of what the roading component is now. Not to say the two aren't cumulative, but we changed our question to ask, is a roadbed nothing more than a human-made beaver dam as far as the impacts on the riparian environment? Now, this work, I have to give credit to two of my graduate students. Catherine Martell and Nadell Flynn have done a bang-up job under some pretty tough conditions looking at the microsite impacts of beavers felling trees, flooding the riparian zone, building dams, and ultimately plugging culverts. And Nadell looking at a higher resolution, a larger scale resolution using GIS or geographic information systems to inspect the orientation of dams, the spacing, the size streams, and the width of the riparian zones. And beavers are completely reconfiguring these zones.
What was the conclusion?
Well, we're in the third year of a two-year study, which is not uncommon for master's students. We haven't got the ultimate conclusion yet. This is a work in progress. There's a nice story here. We can't call them different because we find virtually no culverted roadbeds that don't have beaver influence. Beavers are attuned to find flowing water and plug it. They encounter a roadbed, and that what they see is a beaver dam that's 99% complete. All they have to do is plug this small 1 meter culvert, and they have their pond built. So consequently, virtually every roadbed is also a beaver dam now.
Does it make sense then to take the beavers out?
Sometimes that's necessary. You remember those nuclear beaver families I talked about? The 2-year-old, what we call the teenager beavers, are constantly being booted out of mom and dad's lodge, and they have to go somewhere, and they go find a nice, neat roadbed, a pre-made dam, if you will. All they have to do is plug that blankety-blank culvert, and they've got a home built. So over and over, they fell trees, plug the culverts. They are then classified as a nuisance beaver, and trappers are sent in to take these beavers out. And they do. They're not wasted. The furs are used because they try to trap during the trapping season. But there's a net sink to the population here. That doesn't mean beavers will be endangered again. What it means is it's one of the spinoffs of road networks is they cause a certain chronic removal of beavers.
Well, it sounds too like it makes it easier for the beaver to make his dam.
Yeah, it makes it really easy. That was one of the real problems of our study is we couldn't make a clean distinction between what was and wasn't a beaver dam. The roads basically became beaver dams. They function a little differently. They don't leak the same way. They don't blow out as often. They're like a permanent beaver dam on the landscape. But beavers do fell trees nearby, and they do change the water flow patterns there. So we had to change the study somewhat and look at the impact that beavers were having. And we actually went back in time. If we look at a set of aerial photos from 1949, 1970, and 1999, those were three of our better dates, what we see is virtually no beaver dams on the landscape, a nice, narrow, forested riparian corridor, very little road activity, and very little power line, pipeline, or cut line activity. 1978, we see some human impacts, and we see the occasional beaver dams. 1999, what we see is lots and lots of upland impacts, beaver dams scattered throughout, usually 8 to 10 times as many beaver dams on the landscape, wider riparian zones that are showing the mowing effect of these beavers working on the upland. And so we can just see both of these things unfolding at the same time. Now, I know that you have a bit of an interest, and a lot of your listeners will have an interest, in the riparian buffer strips that the operating ground rules of Alberta Forestry require forest harvesters to leave there. And I hate to say, but a lot of those are destined to become beaver food. If it's poplar, it's probably going to ultimately be felled by beavers. That 60 meter swath on either side of the stream channel, its highest and best use is probably as beaver food. They deliver it to the stream as coarse, woody debris and just the right rate for insect colonization. They provide nesting cavities for buffalo heads and golden eyes, and they provide they build dams that provides habitat for otters and muskrats and dragonflies. And it's this little corridor of ribbon of biodiversity that runs through sometimes an industrial landscape. And even though they may cost us a little timber, in the long run, beavers are a tremendous friend to our biodiversity system in Alberta.
So in that sense, it's really important to continue to maintain those riparian or buffer strips in the forestry operations?
Exactly. That's one of the functions I think buffer strips provide. They do lots of other things. They provide building material for beavers. They provide food source for beavers. And, you know, they may also keep the beavers out of the regenerating plantations. Beavers love nothing more than a nice, succulent stand of head-high aspen suckers. So in some ways, we're baiting the beavers out of there. Beavers will normally forage up to about 60 meters from the water's edge. They get very antsy beyond that because they're coyote bait. They're black bear bait. There are a few things that eat beavers. And so their foraging range is between 30 and 60 meters from the water, where they can fell trees, chew the bark, drag building materials back downslope to build their dams, and that's just coincidentally just about the size of our buffer strips.
What would be the part that beavers play in sort of the total ecology or the ecosystem? Why are they important?
Yeah, I'll answer this from two different perspectives. First, from the forest industry perspective, beavers are probably one of the most effective reclamation units you've got. They provide a stair-step-like series of ponds that are water quality enhancement agents. They stop the sediments from runoff from roads or from any harvesting operation or even oil well pads. They give us a chance, give the sediments a chance to settle out, to be aggregated, flocculated, fall out, and so the water quality downstream is much higher. They're good that way. The other perspective I would take this from is from a broad-scale ecological perspective. Beavers are engineers. Beavers engineer habitats for a lot of wetland-dependent species. In the short term, I mentioned dragonflies, otters, things like that. In the long term, they provide a level of diversity. As each beaver dam fills up, turns into a wet meadow, or gets abandoned, it turns into wet meadow, moose pasture, what some people might call it, willow flats. Eventually, the stream will carve through there, move sediments out. It becomes suitable for beaver colonization again. Trees have grown up somewhat along the edge. It gets reflooded. So if we could do a time-lapse photography from a satellite over time, what we would see is a ribbon of creek with little beaver patches popping up and disappearing, popping up, disappearing. So we have spatial variability, we have temporal variability, but we still have a continuity along our riparian zone that lots and lots of species use.
Well, the reason you're looking at this is to try and come up with some management ideas for people who are in the forest and building roads, whether it's for oil and gas or forestry or whatever. Any idea at this point what you might be able to say to managers in terms of this interrelationship between beavers, beaver dams, and road building?
Yes, we need to think outside of the box. The standard old culvert crossing just won't get it in this era of beaverness. They're going to be plugged, and you're going to have an ongoing maintenance headache on your hands. More and more, we see the progressive companies moving to putting in small bridges, and that pretty well thwarts beavers. They'll try, but they don't work. And so bridges make a lot of sense, less hydrological interruption. They're more expensive. The second thing I'd say is consider some really innovative approaches that people haven't done around here. Things like French drains. A French drain is a large cobble substrate that the water can actually move through, and a beaver can't very effectively plug that. A bit of interesting natural history. Beavers are tremendously attracted to the sound of running water, and instinctively they try to plug that up. A French drain doesn't gurgle, so beavers aren't going to hear that. One researcher put a continuous loop tape player of water sounds on a beaver dam, and it just about drove the beavers crazy. They built a 6-foot wall of mud all the way around it, and they couldn't make it shut up. You know?
What's left to do in your study?
Well, it's a lot of interpretation to do and get these two wonderful women graduated. I'll be going up to talk to some of our industrial partners, and we're going to brainstorm. I'm going to pick their brains. They're going to pick mine, and we're going to try to come up with the most innovative approach to these problems and opportunities we can. And try to figure out if this, what happens when beavers come and go. Are we at a current peak of beaver numbers, or is this a one-time blip, or are they here to stay at this level? This recolonization may be a bit of overshooting of beaver populations. The other thing I am interested in, and we'll try to tease out, is to model this beaver scenario into the entire northeastern quadrant of Alberta, and see what benefits and what costs beaver bring to humans on the landscape.
Thank you very much.
Oh, it's been great. Thanks, Cheryl.
That was Dr. Lee Foote, an associate professor in the Department of Renewable Resources at the University of Alberta and a researcher with the Adaptive Management Experiment Team. Modern forestry got its start in Alberta in the foothills near Hinton. To celebrate its 50th anniversary, Weldwood commissioned a book. But the result is much more than a glossy pat on the back. Learning from the forest, a 50-year journey towards sustainable forest management, is a fascinating compilation of historical anecdotes and scientific research that illustrates the evolution of Alberta's forest industry. Those who had a hand in bringing it all together are Bob Udell, a senior forester now retired from Weldwood, Dr. Peter Murphy, a professor emeritus at the University of Alberta, and Bob Bott, a writer specializing in environmental issues. I spoke with Bob Bott at his home in Calgary.
The company history became a case study for illustrating the way forest management has evolved, first from sort of let nature do it, we'll take what timber we need, the forest is inexhaustible, prior to 1955, to sustained yield from 55 to around 1990 when the new concept called sustainable forest management came along, which is managing for all the values of the forest. We started looking at how different ideas and trends have been tested and put to use on this one land base. It was one of the first places where adaptive forest management, incorporating science on a continuous basis, was really put into play. And that reflected the two men who really created that forest management area, made it what it is.
How far back does that go? Tell me a little bit about the history and these two men.
Well, when the Forest Act was amended in 1949 to allow for large area-based leases of forest to support large industrial enterprises like pulp mills. And that act included a provision for perpetual sustained yield, although it wasn't very well defined. When the company, the partnership of an entrepreneur named Robert Rubin here in Alberta, and the St. Regis Paper Company, which later became Champion and now is part of International Paper, this company, then known as Northwest Pulp and Power Company, got the first lease to build the pulp mill at Hinton. And then they set about figuring out how to fulfill this rather vague idea of perpetual sustained yield. So as their first chief forester, they hired a man named Des Crosley, who had been one of the leading silvicultural researchers in the Canadian Forest Service. He did all the pioneering research on pine and spruce regeneration in the Alberta foothills, especially in the late 40s and early 50s. So the whole idea of scarifying or digging up sites after they're harvested and creating a seed bed for the new generation was from Crosley's work. So they hired him to be the first chief forester. His counterpart in the government, with whom he had to negotiate the ground rules, the way forestry would actually be carried out, was Reg Loomis, who was a forester originally from Quebec and who had worked in New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and Ontario, and had seen a lot of bad forestry. And he was determined that those practices wouldn't be repeated in Alberta. The two of them disagreed a lot about specifics. Loomis never accepted the idea of clear cuts. He always argued for selective or shelter cuts. But he said if Crosley wanted to try his ideas, he would have to prove that they were working. So there was a dynamic between the two of them where the company had to keep doing research, keep proving that its practices were sustainable. This was 30, 40 years before people started talking about adaptive management. But if you look back at the first ground rules that were, well, they were officially signed in 1958 after several years of negotiation, those ground rules, almost exactly the same wording that people use now to talk about adaptive management.
When you look at that early legacy, it's certainly being borne out today with the Foothills Model Forest, which is also in this Hinton area. What do you see coming out of that?
Well, what happened was for the first 30-odd years, the goal was primarily producing timber. Produce timber, keep as long as there was new forest growing and the mill was meeting its requirements, everybody was fairly happy, although more and more uses came onto the land in terms of coal and oil and gas and recreation. In the 80s, we started trying to incorporate wildlife into forest management in Alberta, much greater degree. And a concept that's now called sustainable forest management emerged in the late 80s and early 90s. It goes by various names, ecological management and multiple use sustained management, and you know, but sustainable forest management is what most people call it. And it requires a lot of science and study of things like socioeconomics, recreation, and so on. And then incorporating all those values and figuring out what they actually mean for the harvest. Where are you going to harvest? Where are you going to build roads? How are you going to shape your cut blocks? All those things now are the result of intensive study. And the Foothills Model Forest was established in 1992 as one of the 10 model forests across Canada to bring together industry, government, and academic scientists to answer these questions and to provide that continuing scientific input so that adaptive forest management can actually be carried out meaningfully.
Just looking at the book, when you look at the significance of the history of Weldwood to the history of forestry in Alberta, there's certainly had a number of firsts. What are some of those? You have them listed in your book.
Well, it was the first forest management agreement, and there's now, I can't remember, there's about 17 in Alberta, ranging from about 50,000 hectares to almost 6 million hectares. But anyway, the million-hectare Hinton forest management area was the first. And in doing that, it was the first company to accept full responsibility for forest management, which means planning, inventories, reforestation, road building, all of those things that go into managing the forest. It was also the first pulp mill to anywhere to rely primarily on lodgepole pine. As I mentioned, those were the first operating ground rules between a company and the government on how to conduct the forest, and they included the requirement for continual testing of whether what was being done was actually achieving its goals. It was the first detailed forest management plan written in Alberta. First, in 1965, they established the first forest industry tree nursery, because they needed to plant, especially on the spruce sites, plant seedlings. In the 80s, it was the first company in Alberta to integrate wildlife planning into the forest management planning. And that became a model for what now almost every company in Alberta is doing. In 1988, Rick Bonner was hired as the first wildlife biologist on staff with a forest company in Alberta. And in 89, they established the first public advisory committee. Again, now virtually every company has some form of public advisory committee. In 1999, they became the first company to have planted 100 million trees in Alberta. And in 2000, they became the first forest management area in Alberta, and at that time the largest, to be certified under the Canadian Standards Association standard for sustainable forest management. So it's quite a list, and I think that they hope to continue at the leading edge.
What is it that really stands out for you?
Well, I think the first thing that continues to amaze me is the complexity of forestry. It's the only field I know where the same person is expected to know very advanced mathematics to do things like timber supply analysis and also be able to go to a public meeting of loggers or Aboriginal people or farmers and explain all of these concepts in terms that they can understand. And it brings together, you know, everything from wildlife biology to hydrology to soil science to silviculture. The whole business of growing trees is absolutely fascinating. So the complexity is the first thing that struck me, and that it's a very applied science. So it's science that you have to put to work and then see what happens, and you're doing it on a very large scale. I mean, most of us have trouble conceiving even a couple of hectares, and when you start thinking in terms of hundreds of thousands of hectares, that's a very big area.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
That was Bob Bott, a writer from Calgary and co-author of the new book, Learning from the Forest, A 50-Year Journey Towards Sustainable Forest Management. The book is available from Fifth House Publishing. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Ducks Unlimited Canada, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Research Council, the Science Alberta Foundation, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Ingenuity, and the Alberta Conservation Association. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.